The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Thank you very much. It's always an honor and pleasure to be able to share with people my experience and my story, and it's really an honor that I'm able to come to Santa Barbara today and share with you what I experienced down in Guantanamo and afterwards. I want to start first by thanking all of those who were really instrumental in bringing me here and inviting me here to speak tonight, to all of you. And of course, I want to thank all of you who came out tonight to hear a little bit of my story. And I think it's one that everyone really should know about, should hear about, because it directly relates to much of what is ongoing today in this so-called war on terror, specifically with Guantanamo. Let me first start by telling you a little bit more of my background. Yes, I'm a third-generation Chinese-American, meaning it was my grandparents who immigrated here to the United States in the mid to early 1920s, both my parents being born here. I graduated from West Point in 1990, the United States Military Academy. But not only am I a West Point graduate, I actually come from a family that is rather rooted in the military. I also have another younger brother who also graduated from West Point. I have another younger brother who is currently serving on active duty in the U.S. Army as an Army doctor. And my father also served in the ranks of our military, being drafted during World War II. So all of the males in my family have actually served in the United States Army, and that's something we're all proud of with regard to our individual contributions towards this nation's security. But not only is my family rooted in the military, but I'm someone who now has served in two of our nation's conflicts. I was deployed. I'm a former soldier that was deployed to a declared combat zone in the aftermath of the first Gulf War with a Patriot Missiles Battalion. And I'm also a Muslim convert, as you heard in the short intro. I converted to Islam in 1991, not long after graduating from West Point. And that's a very important part of my story, because that ultimately would tell how I would then become a Muslim chaplain to serve within the ranks. I would return back to active duty after leaving, converting to Islam, studying traditionally in Syria, learning a little bit of the Arabic language to learn how to properly recite the Holy Quran, and then return to active duty in January of 2001, but now not this time as an air defense artillery officer, but now as a Muslim chaplain. When I converted to Islam, I had actually hoped that perhaps one day I might be the first Muslim chaplain to serve the ranks. For when I converted to Islam, I was in the military, and this was a time when there weren't Muslim chaplains. There were Jewish chaplains, there were Christian chaplains, but this was a time when there weren't any Muslim chaplains, and I thought maybe one day I would be the first. But when I returned to active duty in January of 2001, I wasn't the first Muslim chaplain. By this time, there were a couple Muslim chaplains serving, a couple in the Navy, a couple in the Air Force, and there was even a small handful in the U.S. Army, about 10 or so. But in January of 2001, I was the newest Muslim chaplain. If we fast forward just 9 quick months later, we all know what happened. September 2001. September 11th, 2001. The tragic attacks on the World Trade Center. The attack on the Pentagon. United 93 flight, which went down in Pennsylvania. All happened in September 2001. Immediately following those attacks, I was someone who was turned to by senior level leaders in the military and tasked, requested to begin talking about Islam to troops, to soldiers who were serving in the ranks. I would hold training sessions, briefings, lectures about Islam to those who were serving in the army and other U.S. military service members. You can imagine that after the attacks of 9/11, many soldiers had questions about Islam. Many Americans had questions about Islam following those attacks. But at that time, my audience were those who were serving the ranks. And I answered many of these soldiers' questions about Islam. And many of them came away with a much better understanding of this religion, the religion that I myself had converted to, the religion that I had gone overseas and studied traditionally, the religion that I was now representing as a Muslim chaplain in the United States Army. And for my contributions in this immediate post 9/11 aftermath, I was praised and recognized, again, at the highest levels of people in the Pentagon and in the State Department, being characterized as someone who was building bridges, who was educating others about the Muslim culture. Now, why was I asked to do this in this immediate post 9/11 era? I would speculate that perhaps it was because senior level leaders in our country knew immediately following those attacks that many of our soldiers would be deployed to Muslim lands, Muslim countries like Afghanistan, Muslim countries like Iraq, and perhaps many of the soldiers who attended my briefings were actually deployed to either Iraq or Afghanistan. Or maybe some of these soldiers were deployed to Iraq once or twice, or maybe three times now. And maybe some of those soldiers who attended my briefings and learned a little bit of something about Islam were deployed to one of these nations but never came home. But nevertheless, I was someone who was being praised and recognized for that contribution, building bridges, educating others about Islam and the Muslim culture. And I received that praise and recognition, and I believe it was that praise and recognition that would then get me handpicked, specifically chosen to become the Muslim chaplain, to be assigned the task of being the Muslim chaplain down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the location of the controversial prison camp where today some 385 or so individuals still remain being held. When I was assigned to this Joint Task Force prison operation in November of 2002, the numbers were much higher. There were some 660 prisoners at that time being held in Guantanamo. And what's intriguing about this camp and the prisoners there is that each and every one of these prisoners is a Muslim. And that caused me also to speculate why I was being assigned to Guantanamo. Why was I, as a Muslim chaplain, being assigned to this prison operation in which every prisoner, 660 or so, are all Muslims? I speculated that perhaps it was because our government, the Pentagon, simply wanted to say, well, sure, we do have 660 or so prisoners down here who are all Muslim, but we also have our Muslim chaplain down here. And that means we're being very sensitive to the religious needs of these Muslim prisoners. That means we're treating them in a very humane fashion or manner. I speculated that that was the reason why I was sent to Guantanamo. Maybe that was the reason I was sent to Guantanamo. And maybe it wasn't. But when I got down to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, I learned that I did have two definitive roles. One role was to be an advisor to the prison camp commander of the detention operation. On this very unique religious paradigm where we do find that every single one of these prisoners is a Muslim, I was to advise on how the religious routine, how the religious practices of these Muslim prisoners affected this detention operation. That was one role. The other role that I held down in Guantanamo was to be a Muslim chaplain, not only to these 660 Muslim prisoners, but I was also a Muslim chaplain to the many American Muslims who are down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, serving patriotically to this Joint Task Force mission. And the American Muslims down in Guantanamo, they were essentially my congregation as I held the weekly Friday worship service for Muslims. It was the American Muslims who were able to attend. But I was also a Muslim chaplain to the prisoners of Guantanamo Bay, the Muslim prisoners down there. And in this role as a Muslim chaplain to the prisoners, I was granted, authorized, unescorted access into the prison cell blocks of this prison camp. I was one of the very few individuals down in Guantanamo who was able to speak freely and openly with these Muslim prisoners. I was also able to listen to them. Perhaps most importantly, I was able to listen to these prisoners. Why? Because we would say in the military that a good chaplain is a good listener. And that's what I would do, focus my efforts simply on listening to these Muslim prisoners down in Guantanamo when I met with them inside the cell blocks. And by listening to them, I was able to understand much of what was going on in Guantanamo. Much of what was going on, not only inside the cell blocks to which I had access to, but I was also able to understand much of what was going on in the interrogation rooms, of which I was far removed from. Now, down in Guantanamo, there are essentially two operations. There's a detention operation, which is handled and run by military police, military guards. They handle the everyday needs of these prisoners, these Muslim prisoners. They bring the prisoners their meals and pass it to them through the slot in their door. They give the prisoners changes of clothes when they need. They escort prisoners down to recreation or to the showers, as that's the only time that they're let out of their cells. This is one operation. The other operation is that intelligence gathering operation. The job of this operation is to extract information, intelligence, from these prisoners held down in Guantanamo, if they might have any. Who's in this operation? You had interrogators, military interrogators, and you had other interrogators working to interrogate the prisoners to get that information. But who are these other interrogators and intelligence officers who were working with these military interrogators? Well, for us who were in the military, that wore the army uniform, we actually only knew of them as others. Others, because those others didn't wear the military uniform. They instead wore khaki shorts or khaki slacks and polo shirts. And they were on a 9-to-5 schedule, not a 24/7 schedule like those of us who serve in the military. So who were these others? And in fact, in the military, we had an acronym for these others. It was OGA. What's OGA? OGA means other government agencies. And who were these other government agencies? That could be the FBI, CIA, Homeland Security, the Defense Intelligence Agency, other government agencies. They worked alongside the military interrogators, interrogating the prisoners to try and extract that information. Do we have any OGA here tonight? Any? Any out there? How about future OGA? Well, if you are, we welcome you. And we hope that you will learn something today. These are the two operations down in Guantanamo. Detention and intelligence gathering. As the Muslim chaplain, I, of course, was assigned to the detention operation. Because it would be unethical for a chaplain of any denomination to work alongside interrogators trying to extract information. So, of course, I was assigned to the detention operation, work with the guards, relieve much of that tension between the prisoner and the guards, help that part of the operation run much more efficient and smoothly. But in my role as a Muslim chaplain to the prisoners, in listening to them, in speaking with them, I was able to learn much of what was going on inside that intelligence operation and in those interrogation rooms. As prisoners would tell me that when they were taken to interrogation, they were shackled. They were shackled at the wrist and at the waist and at the ankles. And the prisoners would come back and they would tell me that when they were taken to an interrogation, perhaps a particular interrogation room, it was one that had what was marked on the floor, a circle. Circle marked on the floor. But it wasn't just an ordinary circle. it was a circle that had the symbol of Satan in it, the pentagram symbol. And the interrogator would attempt to take this shackled prisoner, force that prisoner in the center of that satanic circle, and force him to bow down and to prostrate, like in the form of the Islamic prayer, while that interrogator would scream at that prisoner that Satan is your God now, not Allah. This is what prisoners would tell me when they got taken to interrogation. And I became disturbed by some of these things when I would hear things like this. And what was disturbing to me was that as a chaplain who's in the United States military, whose role is essentially to defend religious freedom, to advocate for what we call in our U.S. Constitution, the free exercise of worship, what was disturbing to me was that religion was being used against these prisoners to try and break them in the course of interrogating them or in the course of detaining them. That was what was disturbing to me, mostly, the use of religion against these prisoners. And that's something that I would refer to later when I documented my experience, which I called Gitmo's secret weapon. Gitmo, as it refers to Guantanamo, had that secret weapon, which I called the use of religion against these prisoners. And I learned of how they were doing this by forcing these prisoners in that satanic circle. I would learn how they would do this, use religion against these prisoners to try and break them. And it was because each and every one of these prisoners is a Muslim, it was the use specifically of Islam against these prisoners to try and break them. How else was that being done? There were many female interrogators down in Guantanamo. And the command would always tell the media and the journalists who came down to visit that these female interrogators down in Guantanamo were an essential part of the intelligence gathering operation, mainly because they had very creative approaches to gathering intelligence. And what was so creative about their approach? And let me tell you, female interrogators down in Guantanamo would exploit what I call conservative Islamic etiquette or conservative Islamic culture, where you find in a Muslim society very limited contact, limited physical contact between members of the opposite sex, between men and women, especially in public, really out of the idea of modesty for one another or respect for one another. Even you find limited handshaking between men and women in a conservative Islamic society. Female interrogators would exploit this aspect of Muslim culture, because they were very ready to conduct their interrogations of these Muslim male prisoners after they would strip their clothes off, stand naked in front of these Muslim prisoners, thinking that was going to maybe frustrate them because they come from these conservative societies. But these female interrogators would go further than that. They would inappropriately rub their bodies, their private areas, on these shackled Muslim prisoners as they sat in their chairs. They went further than that. Perhaps some of these female interrogators down in Guantanamo would give these Muslim male prisoners free lap dances. Now, where can you get a free lap dance these days? Down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, if you're a Muslim male prisoner. But it went further than that. As it's been suggested in command investigations into abuses down in Guantanamo, as well as in some of these FBI memos that have been disclosed, that female interrogators even went so far as grabbing the genitals of these Muslim male prisoners in the course of interrogating them. Now, when I learned of this type of behavior, utterly disturbed. As well were some of the other Muslim Americans who were down there, many of whom were translators. Some of them even translated for some of these interrogations. And this American Muslim community down in Guantanamo felt that this type of behavior on the part of these women interrogators was, of course, not only degrading to the prisoners, but we felt it was degrading to these female interrogators themselves for engaging in this type of behavior. But even further than that, it's degrading to all women in general, every woman in this room, Because what were these interrogators doing? They were essentially presenting themselves, American women, as simply sex objects in front of these Muslim male prisoners. This is how religion was being used against the prisoners. Let me give you another example. We heard in 2005 about the desecration of the Quran, the desecration of the Holy Quran down in Guantanamo. And when this news broke, this was news that led to outrage in the entire Muslim world. It led to protests. People were protesting that American personnel down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, were desecrating the Holy Quran. And in some of these protests, being quelled by government law enforcement, people were even killed. But they were essentially protesting because the Holy Quran was being abused and desecrated down in Guantanamo. Now, why did we have these protests? It's because Muslims all around the world hold the Holy Quran in respect and reverence. It's considered the literal words of God to all Muslims. In a Muslim's home, the Quran is stored or put on the highest shelf in one's home. It's never put in anywhere that's dirty or filthy. It's never brought into the restroom. A Muslim student will never take the Holy Quran and put it under his or her chair or desk, because then you would be sitting over the Quran, and that would be disrespectful. This is how the Holy Quran is treated by Muslims all over the world. It's very similar to what you find in Judaism, when you find the Holy Scriptures held at the front of the synagogue in an ark under lock and key. And perhaps it's only the rabbi who is able to handle the Holy Scriptures or even be the one to actually write or script what's considered the words of God in Judaism. In Islam, the Holy Quran is held with that respect as well. But down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, personnel would exploit this aspect of Muslim faith in desecrating the Holy Quran. And that was being done in many different ways. As I can confirm as the Muslim chaplain who was assigned to Guantanamo, that yes, indeed, the Holy Quran was being abused, was being desecrated by people in Guantanamo. How was that being done? Well, I recall when I first got down to Guantanamo, how the guards, when they searched the cells, each cell having a Quran, each prisoner having a Quran, the guards would conduct their cell search. Now, of course, in any prison operation, there's a need for proper security operations, searching cells for contraband or a potential weapon. But when they searched the Holy Qurans, they would take the Qurans. They would turn them upside down, shake them violently, thinking that something dangerous might fall out of the Quran. Of course, nothing dangerous ever fell out of the Quran. And Muslims, of course, would know that hiding something in the Quran would be something disrespectful, not only to the words of God, but to Islam. But nevertheless, there is a need for proper security procedures. But when the guards shook the Qurans looking for something dangerous, it was instead the pages of the Quran that were torn. It was the bindings that were ripped and cracked. And when the guards finished searching the Quran, they would toss it on the floor just like any other item that they would search. And then they move on to their next piece of item to search. The prisoners are held in these open-air cell-like cages made of steel mesh so they could observe how the guards would conduct these searches and handle the Qurans. And when they got tossed on the floor recklessly, prisoners became furious. They began to protest. But how could they protest from within their cells made of this steel mesh? Wasn't much they can do except bang on the steel beds or bang on the steel doors when the guards were throwing the Qurans on the ground. Then they would grab their cups. They had, some of them had styrofoam cups. Fill it up with water and throw water at the guards. That's about all they could do really to protest. But then these protests actually got a little more extreme. They found some other ways to protest. They protested by going on hunger strikes and then even suicide attempts, trying to hang themselves in protest of how the Holy Qurans were being abused and desecrated. But these more extreme measures of protest started to take place when interrogators inside the interrogation room were now taking the Holy Quran, tossing him on the floor in front of the shackled prisoner, would stamp on it. And prisoners would tell me how these interrogators would even kick the Qurans across the floor. some of these interrogators would even sit on the Holy Quran. And this infuriated the prisoners. And when prisoners learned that this was happening now in the interrogation room by interrogators, this is when you found these more extreme protests occurring. As prisoners tried to hang themselves, again, not wanting to witness the Holy Quran being desecrated, rather dying before seeing the holy words of God being abused and trampled. And indeed, one of those prisoners actually landed himself in a coma after what was estimated to be about 5 minutes that he had cut his own oxygen off in a hanging attempt. Miraculously, that prisoner did come out of that coma months later. However, he was a man in his young 20s. But after suffering brain damage, he's no longer like a young man in his young 20s. And medical personnel would tell me that he'll probably be like a fifth grader for the rest of his life suffering that brain damage. He was protesting over the desecration of the Quran. And then all of a sudden, I think some of the intelligence agents and intelligence officials, they woke up. Especially when that guy put himself in a coma. Because the desecration of the Quran was not good for anyone. It wasn't good for the prisoners. It wasn't good for American Muslims who also respected and revered the Holy Quran. It wasn't good for the guards because now you had utter chaos in the prison cell blocks. But it even wasn't good for the intelligence operation. Because now there wasn't any valuable exchange of information. Prisoners wouldn't talk to the interrogators about anything except ask them why they were desecrating the Holy Quran. Why were they abusing the holy words of God? Was it simply because all the prisoners were Muslim? But also the intelligence operation, they figured something out. They asked themselves, what happens if one of these prisoners does commit suicide? What would that mean if a prisoner commits suicide as a result of our desecrating the Holy Quran? What's the consequence? They realized that if one of these prisoners did end up dead, committing suicide, it would mean that that prisoner could no longer be considered an intelligence asset. Meaning what? You can't interrogate that prisoner anymore. He's dead. Not another word is going to come from that prisoner's mouth after he commits suicide. And the intelligence then, I believe, woke up. And they said, no, we don't want these prisoners committing suicide. We don't want any prisoners dying. They quickly realized we need to solve this problem. But they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to solve this problem that they themselves created. So then they got even more clever. And then they would turn to me, saying, Chaplain, what do we do? How do we solve this problem? We don't want prisoners dying. And I thought about it for a while, and I came up with something. It was something simple. And it helped relieve much of the tension down in Camp Delta. It was a simple policy. I authored a policy. We call it a standard operating procedure in the military. It was a policy that simply allowed the prisoner himself to show the guard from within his cell, there's nothing hidden in the Quran. And then the Quran would be stored high up in his cell on the steel mesh in a simple cloth hanger. And it was a simple surgical mask, a cloth surgical mask that I was able to get from the medical facility. Distribute one to each prisoner, it would serve as a Quran holder. And only after the Quran is shown to the guard, there's nothing hidden in it, he would put it in the Quran holder. And when that prisoner needed to come out of his cell, that prisoner would be shackled to the slot in his door at the wrist, the waist, and at the ankles, as prisoners down in Guantanamo are shackled. And only then is the door of his cell unlocked. So my policy was simple. It took into account basically two things. It took into account proper security operations to ensure that all personnel would be safe. Because if there was a possibility that a prisoner was able to hide something in the Quran, by the time he's let out of his cell, he's already shackled, and that the possibility of him then being able to retrieve something in the Quran and then using it to harm someone was virtually impossible. But my policy also took into account respect for the Quran. It limited the amount of contact the guards would have with the Quran so they wouldn't be roughly handled, violently shaken upside down, or even tossed on the ground. And prisoners appreciated that because the guards would no longer be physically handling the holy book. That relieved much of the tension in the cell blocks. And this type of contribution is what I was praised for and recognized in making that detention operation run a lot much more smoothly and efficiently. But in general, these are the types of examples that were being carried out down in Guantanamo, in which I saw it as a way to break the prisoner through the use of religion. Using religion as a weapon against these prisoners. There were many other ways in which that was being done, to include forcibly shaving the beards of Muslim prisoners down in Guantanamo, as some Muslims consider having a beard an obligation upon Muslims. It went further than that, and I even continued to learn about how this was taking place in ways that I didn't even know about when I was down in Guantanamo. I recently learned about a report in which a prisoner down in Guantanamo, and again, this is something I wasn't aware of when I was down there. I learned that a prisoner in an interrogation room was visited by an interrogator who was dressed up like a priest. And then that priest would go ahead and forcefully baptize that prisoner, thinking that was going to maybe frustrate that prisoner or something. Baptize that Muslim prisoner against his will. This is how religion was being used against prisoners. The desecration of religious symbols, Muslim religious symbols, like the Quran, was not the only religious symbols that were being desecrated down in Guantanamo. There was another religious symbol that, in my view, was being desecrated. But it wasn't a Muslim symbol. It was a Jewish symbol. It was the Star of David, which you find on the Israeli flag. Interrogators would take the Israeli flag and they would wrap it around the prisoner, thinking that too was going to frustrate the prisoner and break him. But that, in my view, would be a desecration not only of the flag, the Israeli flag, but also of that religious symbol, the Star of David. There was also religious discrimination against the Jewish religion that was going on down in Guantanamo. Of course, there was this anti-Muslim hostility that was down there that was felt not only by the prisoners, but also felt by the American Muslims. But there was also some hostility towards the Jewish religion. Because interrogators would tell the prisoners when they learned that for the first time some of them were going to be visited by attorneys, lawyers, who had now gained the right to see prisoners down in Guantanamo. What did these interrogators tell the prisoners? They told these prisoners, don't trust you, these attorneys that you're about to see. Why? Because they're Jewish. And they're against you. They're not here to help you. So don't treat them. Don't trust them. And indeed, many of these attorneys who are defending prisoners down in Guantanamo are Jewish. And they were outraged when they learned that American personnel, military personnel, would tell prisoners, don't trust these attorneys simply because they're Jewish. There was discrimination, religious discrimination, going on down in Guantanamo. Not only towards Muslims, but also of those of the Jewish faith. This is how religion was being used as a weapon. And when we think about this idea, it goes against the fundamental character of who we are as a nation. When you think about the First Amendment and the freedom of religion, the advocacy for free exercise of worship, this goes directly counter to our American values. If you go a little bit further, back in history, when those who landed in America on Plymouth Rock, they came for a reason. They were in search of something. And what was that something? It was religious freedom. That was the very first cause established here. And here in Guantanamo, we see American personnel trampling over religious freedom. For me, that was the most disturbing thing, especially because I was serving in the military as a chaplain. And my role was essentially to do just that, advocate for that American value of religious freedom. But what about physical abuse? Was there any physical, actual physical abuse that was happening down in Guantanamo? Sure, there was physical abuse as well. There were times when I saw prisoners being dragged through the gravel simply because guards felt that they were walking too slow when they were being escorted to interrogation. But there was another incident that actually happened in Guantanamo when I was there. And this incident is a little bit humorous just because of how it happened, but it's very sad as to what the ultimate result would be. This was a situation in where a prisoner had been returned to his cell after being in the recreation area or the showers. And somehow the guard neglected to lock the door of that cell. Whether it was intentional or by accident or neglect, depends on who you talk to, the prisoner or the guard. But that prisoner is now in a cell and the door is unlocked. Adjacent to that prisoner is an empty cell. The prisoner who's normally in that cell is the one now down in recreation or in the shower. In every cell block, there are four guards. One guard monitors that prisoner down in that recreation area. The other three guards then conduct their cell search. They search that empty cell for contraband or perhaps a dangerous weapon. And adjacent to that cell, that empty cell where the three guards are searching, is that prisoner in the unlocked cell. And what does that prisoner do? That prisoner comes out of his cell and attempts to lock those three guards in that cell. As I said, it's a little bit humorous because it's pretty crafty. But those guards, all of them, probably over 200 pounds. The fourth guard who's down the corridor sees what's happening, comes rushing down. Those four guys were no match for that one prisoner. They were easily able to barge their way out, push the door open, take that prisoner, manhandle him down to the ground, throw him face down on the steel-plated corridor of that cell block. Shackle his hands behind his back. Not with handcuffs, because that would take too long. You need a key. But instead, they use these plastic zip ties, much more expedient. Secured his hands behind his back. Secured his ankles. That prisoner, whatever threat he might have posed in trying to assault those guards, was nullified. The incident should have been stopped there. Perhaps that prisoner should have been then taken to these cells, which is known as MSU down in Guantanamo, maximum security units, much like solitary confinement, and disciplined with a number of days in solitary for coming out of his cell and assaulting the guards. But after that prisoner was down, face down, hands shackled, legs secured, the incident didn't stop there. One of those four guards continued to beat that prisoner on the back of the head with a heavy handheld steel military radio, bludgeoning that prisoner in the back of the head after the threat was already nullified. It was a bloody incident. And by the time I actually arrived on the scene, that prisoner had already been taken away to the infirmary to get his head stitched up. But the pool of blood was still fresh in the center of that cell block. And perhaps even what I saw in that pool of blood were maybe chunks of that prisoner's flesh in that pool of blood. I observed how the prisoners who had witnessed through these open-air steel mesh cells, the witnessing of how that prisoner was bludgeoned on the back of the head. And they were all in a state of shock. Not one of them could actually tell me what happened because they were so much in shock. And those guards themselves were even severely shaken because what happened? They had to pull their colleague off the back of that prisoner to prevent him from killing that prisoner. Those guards themselves were shaken as they had to stop that situation. But it was already too much out of hand. This is what you would consider in the military an excessive use of force. The threat was nullified, but force continued to be applied. This was an incident in where there was severe physical abuse levied on a prisoner. These are the types of disturbing things that were going on in Guantanamo when I was there. And much of this is what I raised concern over, raised to my chain of command in the detention operation, who valued my input. They praised and recognized me for that input because some of those things in the cell blocks we were able to correct and actually make that operation run much more smoothly. But those things that were happening in the interrogation rooms we didn't have any influence over. And the abuses that happened in Guantanamo, much of the gross abuses that occurred down in Guantanamo, come out of the interrogation rooms. And because I, nor my chain of command in the detention operation, had any influence over that intelligence gathering operation, that stuff continued to happen. In any case, I would raise concerns to my chain of command. Get praise, recognition, even be awarded military awards for my time down in Guantanamo. I would also receive a stellar officer evaluation report, 2 days after which I was able to go on a 2-week break. We call it R&R, rest and relaxation. After serving 10 months, being praised, recognized for my contribution, receiving awards, a stellar officer evaluation report, I would get to go home for 2 weeks, see my family, and then come back. Finish the last 2 months, it would be a full year of duty. But when I landed in Jacksonville, Florida, the Naval Air Station, I was stopped by customs officials, seemingly as this would be a routine customs search. But later I actually learned that indeed one of these other OGAs was also involved, and it was the FBI. They had contacted these customs officials even as early as the day before my arrival, instructed these customs officials to single me out, identify me before I even step off that plane, and have me searched. And that's what happened. So now we no longer have what would be a routine customs search, as you might expect when you come back in the country. But this, in my view, was now a search being conducted by an extension of a law enforcement agency, the FBI, without probable cause. And that made that a violation of my Fourth Amendment right to be free from an illegal search and seizure. Well, some people might say, well, big deal. So you had one of your constitutional rights trampled, an illegal search and seizure. It's not like I was carrying something that I wasn't supposed to have had or was doing something wrong or illegal. But it mattered because these customs officials would then say they found in my backpack some suspicious documents. And then they immediately turned these suspicious documents over to several federal and military intelligence officers who also, by the way, just happened to be standing by. How did that happen? Well, of course, it was a sting operation. And then these intelligence officials would say, well, we actually have classified documents here. And then they ran and they got an arrest warrant. And they would throw me in jail, arrest me in secret, and put me in solitary confinement, for which would ultimately be 76 days. I never showed up at the airport in Seattle like I was supposed to have to meet my wife and daughter. It was like I had disappeared, gone, never showed up. They had no idea what happened to me. My wife would call my parents in New Jersey to see if they had heard something from me. And they heard nothing. I was missing. Disappeared in America. But about 10 days later, all of my family, all of the world, would then learn of where I was. I was now sitting in a super maximum security prison down in Charleston, South Carolina, known as the Consolidated Naval Break. Everyone learned of where I was now when I was the news story of the day, that the Muslim chaplain from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, had been arrested and was now being accused of these heinous crimes of spying, espionage, aiding the enemy. And the report was, the news reports were saying, and they might add treason on, as if these other capital crimes weren't already enough. And indeed, in those very first few days, I was threatened with the death penalty by these military prosecutors. But now I'm sitting in this Consolidated Naval Brig in Charleston, South Carolina. And it was interesting, because this is this very same location where they house U.S. citizen enemy combatants. Foreign enemy combatants, we know, are down in Guantanamo or in some of these secret CIA black sites. But if you're declared an enemy combatant and you're a U.S. citizen, you get sent to Charleston, South Carolina at the Consolidated Naval Brig, and that's where they sent me. And the military, the U.S. Southern Command Public Affairs representative would say that sending me to Charleston, South Carolina to this particular prison was also only a coincidence. But this wasn't a coincidence. And I know because of how I was transported there. I was taken from Jacksonville, shackled like a prisoner down in Guantanamo was shackled in the very same way, at the wrist, waist, and ankles. And then they threw me in the back of this truck next to an armed guard. There was two other armed guards in the front, one of them driving. The armed guard next to me would take out of his bag these goggles. They were plastic goggles painted black. And then he would put them on my eyes. Now I can't see anything. He would take out of his bag these heavy industrial type earmuffs, these ear protection, and then put them on my ears. Now I couldn't hear anything. I was shackled like a prisoner down in Guantanamo, and I'm being subjected to what we call sensory deprivation. It's called sensory deprivation. It's done to instill fear and intimidation and confusion. But guess what? I knew about this tactic because that's how I observed the prisoners down in Guantanamo being subjected to this same treatment when they get flown in and in process down at Gitmo. And so when they finally put me in this cell down in Charleston, South Carolina, I was relieved that I was still alive. I had feared that this hood would be thrown on my head, a practice known as hooding. But that practice had been stopped just months before my arrest. I would be in that cell for 76 days as these accusations were flying. The headlines were saying, Captain Yee could be the first military academy graduate convicted of treason. That's what was being said of me. Well, after 76 days, I was suddenly released from prison. I wasn't facing the death penalty or any of these heinous crimes of espionage or spying or aiding the enemy. But instead, the military would charge me with lesser offenses, and they called it mishandling classified information. I went to a pretrial hearing, and by this time, I was able to retain a military law expert to defend me, Mr. Eugene Fidel in Washington, D.C. And what did we do in this pretrial hearing but simply ask the government to give us the results of an official review of anything that they had seized from me to show that indeed I did have something that was classified. Simply to substantiate these accusations, these charges of mishandling classified documents. And the military would say, well, we haven't actually even conducted any such type of investigation or review. I had been arrested in secret, separated from my family, treated like an enemy combatant, threatened with the death penalty, accused of these heinous crimes, locked away in a super maximum security prison in Charleston, and then charged with mishandling classified documents, and the military or the government hadn't even shown I had anything that was classified. What's going on here? So, of course, this pretrial hearing was delayed, and was delayed again, and then again, several times, as months of investigation took place, to try and find a shred of classified information to hold against me, to hold me accountable for these crimes that they now had officially charged me with. But what do you think they found? They didn't find anything. They did find probably receipts from, like, Walmart that when I bought graham crackers or bananas, they probably found my birthday card that my mom sent me in February. They probably found some of these things. And believe me, they all went through a security review and then stamped for official use only. Nothing was stamped classified because I never had anything that was classified. And then after months of this type of investigation, all of a sudden, even these charges that they had brought against me were simply dropped. They were gone. My record was wiped clean. I was sent back to Fort Lewis, Washington, reinstated as a Muslim chaplain. And it wasn't long before I would then tender my resignation from the U.S. military and receive an honorable discharge in January 2005. And as you heard in the introduction, that when I separated from the military, the U.S. Army would give me that second U.S. Army Commendation Medal for, quote, exceptional meritorious service. How do you figure that one out? It's easy. Because what happened to me really was a gross miscarriage of justice. It was a gross miscarriage of justice. And in my view, it happened for three reasons. Two of them found in the subtitle of my book, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. My faith was under fire, simply being an American Muslim in this very dangerous post-9/11 era, where we find that the civil liberties of everyone in this country is under attack. but the Muslim community is under that much more scrutiny. And people in Guantanamo, when they saw myself, an American Muslim, and other American Muslims praying, bowing and prostrating in the form of the Islamic prayer, or reading the Holy Quran in the classical Arabic language, this mirrored how Muslim prisoners prayed and read the Holy Quran, as it mirrors how Muslims all over the world pray and read the Holy Quran. But to these few individuals, it meant to them, whether it was due to ignorance or lack of knowledge or maybe hypervigilance or overzealousness or even sheer bigotry, it meant to them that I too was the enemy and they would come after me. But this also happened, in my view, because of my ethnicity, being a Chinese American. Because I would learn throughout this ordeal, we would find information also. And one of the things that I found out was that one of the initial things that was said about me was, quote, "Who the hell does this Chinese Taliban think he is, telling us how to treat our prisoners?" I was called a Chinese Taliban. Not just a Taliban, but a Chinese Taliban. And to me, that's an indication that someone was disturbed that I'm Chinese American. But also, the third reason is my patriotism. As a chaplain who was down in Guantanamo, advocating for religious freedom, protecting some of the religious rights of these Muslim prisoners, advocating for diversity, advocating for justice, advocating for humane treatment of prisoners, something that is in line with not only domestic law, but international law. People were disturbed that I would have the courage to stand up when I saw something which went against this American value. Perhaps it was those in the intelligence operation who were engaged in this type of behavior and conduct which crossed the line, that in my raising concerns about cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment was perhaps threatening to these individuals, for maybe they were or could be accused of war crimes. And they would quickly do what they could to get me off that island of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And what's the lesson in my story? A simple lesson. That we are living in a very dangerous post-9/11 era. Historic. And that if we look at what happened to me, a West Point graduate, someone who served in two of our nation's conflicts, from a military family, who was being praised and recognized at the highest levels of our government, be treated in such a way that was a gross miscarriage of justice, then it could happen to anyone. And when it happens to a U.S. citizen, what the international world sees is that if a U.S. citizen can't be simply treated fairly under U.S. military justice, then surely a foreigner down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, can't in any way be treated fairly under U.S. military justice. And my case has really served to undermine the current administration's effort to utilize any type of military justice on prisoners down in Guantanamo. And I would say that there's a golden opportunity for the government today to try and restore some of that integrity to U.S. military justice simply by saying to me that they're sorry. To apologize. And I believe that would do wonders just to help restore that credibility to the military justice system, to show that we are a nation that has integrity, to admit mistakes when we've made them. I tend to be an eternal optimist and believe that one day I will get an official apology. But I know many of you out there will say, don't hold your breath. With that, I'm going to cut my story short here. And that I hope it's been inspiring and it has been eye-opening to some of the realities down in Guantanamo and eye-opening to what I myself experienced being treated much like those prisoners down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. I want to be able to open the floor to some questions, but real quickly before I do that, I want to quickly show you about 5 minutes of images to show you a visual of what actually Guantanamo looks like, and that'll give you a much better perspective. With that, my name is Chaplain James Yee. I'm the former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and it's been a pleasure sharing with you my experiences. Thank you very much. Thank you. real quickly, I want to go through this so we have as much time as possible for question and answers. This is the front gates of Camp Delta. Camp Delta is where most of the general population of prisoners were being held when I was there in 2003. This is how prisoners were initially transported to Guantanamo. In the back of these open military cargo planes, strapped and hooded, under the big red, white, and blue flag of our country. And if that's not an indication that we're treating prisoners in this way, I don't know what is. Another look at how prisoners were transported to Guantanamo. Of course, we have very friendly guards in our military. This is a picture of Camp X-Ray. Camp X-Ray was the first camp opened in Guantanamo in January of 2002. It was makeshift, very temporary, only open for about 4 months. The cells in Camp X-Ray were made of chain-link fences, a lot different from the steel mesh of Camp Delta. And this was actually a picture that was disclosed or put out by the military, by the Department of Defense, in an attempt to persuade the international community that we indeed were treating prisoners in a humane fashion. Obviously, it didn't have that effect. Another look at Camp X-Ray. And again, you can see a better look at the chain-link fences, the cells behind the prisoners there. A closer look at sensory deprivation. I was subjected to this very same deprivation, with minus the mask on the mouth. But I had the goggles, the earmuffs, the shackles, and whatnot. Again, Camp X-Ray. A prisoner being escorted to Camp X-Ray. That's essentially how they were showered back in Camp X-Ray. But by the time I got there, Camp X-Ray had already been closed. Camp Delta was in operation. The cells in Camp Delta were much more sturdy. This is a particular cell block. There were 15 to 20 of these cell blocks in Camp Delta. Each cell block had 48 cells, 24 on each side, a quarter down the middle. Let's go inside one of these cell blocks. That's what it looked like. Each one of those doors is a cell. And you can imagine when I narrated that story of the one prisoner who came out of his cell to try and lock the other guards in that adjacent cell, it was in a block like this. That's what it would look like inside the cell. This is a public affairs military released picture, really to show you how spick and span the floor of these cells are. Looks like you can eat off of it. And the military will also tell you that sometimes the prisoners get some of these items, like a game of checkers or a deck of cards or maybe a couple extra packets of salt to make the food taste a little better. Down in Guantanamo, we refer to these things as comfort items because they make the stay of the prisoners in Guantanamo a little more comfortable. But really, this is what they get. An empty cell with a flimsy plastic mattress. And maybe they get some of those comfort items if they cooperate, that's the word they use, cooperate with interrogators. That's the steel mesh, much sturdier than the chain link fences of Camp X-Ray. And what would it be look like to look through this steel mesh every day of your life for going on 6 years now? That's what it would look like, and it would blur your vision. There's a detainee being escorted. And notice how we refer to them always as detainees. Why? Well, down in Guantanamo, we're told, refer to them as detainees because if we call them prisoners, someone might mistakenly think you're meaning prisoner of war. But prisoners of war have rights under Geneva Conventions. But these guys in Guantanamo don't have any rights. They're enemy combatants, unlawful enemy combatants. So make sure you call them detainees. This is the rec area that's behind every cell block. Prisoners had about 15 minutes inside this rec area, individually every 3 or 4 days, followed by a 10-minute shower. The rest of the time was in that cell. That's what they were showering. This is a closer look at the Quran holder, a simple surgical mask used to hold the Quran up high in the cell so guards wouldn't abuse them. Guard towers that surround the camp, several of these guard towers to provide oversight and security. And sometimes we too don these guard towers with the American flag so that when prisoners are abused, that they know without a doubt it was the American government, American military, who did it to them. Heavy artillery that provides security. This is known as Camp 4. In Camp 4, prisoners actually get to live in groups of 10 if they're very cooperative and very well behaved. They lived in groups of 10 inside these cells. As you can see, multiple beds. Prisoners would tell me that this was just like living in solitary confinement, except they had 9 of their friends alongside them, with them. As you can see, there's no windows or anything, except that little back door. But they did have the opportunity for about a half hour of recreation a day, where they can take it in groups, and even provide for praying together, which couldn't be done in the cells of Camp Delta. This is known as Camp Iguana. In Camp Iguana, this is where they held juvenile enemy combatants, known as JECs, juvenile enemy combatants, who were as young as 12 years old. There were prisoners who were as young as 12 years old held in Guantanamo, and they were kept in this facility here. Camp Echo were much more isolated cells, designed, what they said, for high-value detainees. You can see the interrogation room on the right, which facilitated the interrogation of a prisoner where you never had to take that prisoner out of the cell. You could interrogate him right from his cell. You could not even see sunlight in these cells. Much more isolated. Oops. This is Camp 5. Camp 5 was not built in Guantanamo when I was there. It has been subsequently built after I left, as well as Camp 6. And you can see it's like a modern federal prison built here in the U.S. And indeed, it was just, these buildings were modeled after prisons here in the U.S. And it doesn't take a genius to guess who might have got the contract to build one of these facilities, a subsidiary of Halliburton. So there's a Camp 6, which is like this Camp 5. Camp 5 has about 50 of these heavy-duty steel cells, and Camp 6 has about 200, two-tier. This is the interrogation room, simple chair with a D-ring, and that D-ring was used for in a process called short shackling. And let me quickly demonstrate. A prisoner would be shackled at the wrist, the waist, ankles, and that would all be connected to that D-ring. In a stress position, like this, or like this. That prisoner would be there in that position for hours. And if you've seen the movie, The Road to Guantanamo, it presents that. How that was carried out. And sometimes prisoners couldn't take that stress position. They get carted away to the medical facility, the medical hospital down in Guantanamo for detainees. That's what it looked like. But the military will tell you that even in Guantanamo, we have the highest medical technological equipment down there. A brand new dental chair, surgical equipment. They even perform surgeries on prisoners down in Guantanamo. And sometimes they even say that these prisoners get better medical treatment than even our own U.S. service members. But I don't think anyone ever believes them. But they also have these things. These are called feeding chairs, force feeding chairs. Prisoner gets strapped in and he's force fed. Why would he be force fed? Well, when he goes on a hunger strike, loses half of his body weight, they won't allow him to die. So they force feed him with a tube, a plastic tube, that gets shoved through the nose after being lubed with petroleum jelly. These force feeding chairs help stop a hunger strike of about 130 prisoners down to 4 in a matter of 2 days, simply because the prisoners could not take this torturous process of being force fed through the nose. Some of the young prisoners, these guys, obviously they look now 16, 17 when they're home. They were the 12 to 14-year-old prisoners who were down there. As well, this guy was 15, Canadian citizen, high profile case. He's even accused of having killed an American soldier with a hand grenade. Interesting, his brother was in Guantanamo also. I had met him as well. His story is very interesting. He would later be released somehow from Guantanamo, and when he would eventually get back to Canada, where he's a Canadian citizen, he would tell his story about how he was a CIA mole. He was working for the CIA, put in Guantanamo as a prisoner to try and get information from the other prisoners. But he couldn't take the conditions. And he threatened to disclose that he was working for the CIA to other Canadian personnel down there when they came to interrogate Canadian citizens. They quickly let him out, sent him on another mission to infiltrate the Bosnian Muslim community. When he got there, he said, "I had enough." And he fled back to Canada and told his story. And you can find it actually on Frontline. This guy was in Guantanamo. He was known as AKA Santa Claus. And you can see why. Because he has that big white beard and he was about 85 years old. But yet, he was a hardcore terrorist. as was this guy who was 79 and he was released just last August. He couldn't even walk without a walker. He was a hardcore terrorist also. Why are we releasing all these hardcore terrorists? Samuel Hajj, he's actually an Al Jazeera cameraman held down in Guantanamo. High profile in the Muslim world simply because he does work for Al Jazeera. And it's not surprising that he's from Al Jazeera, but I'm sure you'll never find a cameraman from Fox News down there. Mamdouh Habib, who was actually sent to Egypt and tortured in Egypt before going to Guantanamo under a policy known as extraordinary rendition. And the Tipton Three, guys who actually down in Guantanamo confessed to meeting Osama bin Laden. But the British MI5, the British intelligence said, we know your confessions can't be true because we can confirm that at the time of this supposed meeting, you guys were in Britain. You were in the UK. You were employed by this hardware store. We can confirm that you two were also in the UK. So we know you guys never met Osama bin Laden. Sorry, United States of America. And they were released, sent back to Britain, and they came out with their movie, The Road to Guantanamo. With that, I want to ask the audience for some questions. And if we can get the lights. Thank you. Thank you. We got two microphones up front, so anyone who has a question or a comment, I'd like to take some questions. So we'll start here on the right.
Okay, yeah, I have one question. Well, I have two questions. One is about your wife, because I remember reading at the time about some of what she went through, and if you could just elaborate a little bit on what your wife actually had to go through. And the other question is about, you said that you were working on detention and that you weren't assigned to
intelligence
or to get information out of the prisoners. However, because of your Arabic skills and others, I'm sure that the interrogators must have asked you, or they must have tried to get you to get information out of the prisoners.
Right.
So if you could answer both of those.
Right.
Questions.
Yeah, first, my wife perhaps was more traumatized than even me, who was the one sitting in that single solitary cell, as, you know, our house was raided by federal agents. She was interrogated. Media was jumping out of the bushes. Cameras, you know, cameramen, you know, camped out in the apartment complex and whatnot. So, yeah, it was traumatizing very much for my wife. But in terms of the intelligence operation, you know, I had strict guidance from the general that I was not to be involved in any way with the intelligence operation. But yeah, I did one time meet the head of the FBI operation, and he stopped me and said, you know, I'm very interested in your role as a Muslim chaplain and some of the conversations and what you talk about with these prisoners, and I'd really like to sit down with you and talk about this more. And I told him basically, well, you know, I think my schedule is just as busy as yours, and I really don't know if I have the time just to sit down with you and discuss any of these things. I know you must be very busy, and I'm, of course, very busy, but maybe in another life. Basically, I tactfully told, you know, wasn't going to cross the line and get involved, but that was an indication that, yeah, they did. He would have loved to hear what I had to say.
Yeah. Assalamu alaikum. Over the past 4 years, Halliburton has been constructing a network of maximum security prisons all over the U.S. Last I read, there are 7 completed and another dozen under construction. The ostensible reason for these prisons is for the so-called undocumented. How long do you believe it will take before a general roundup of Muslims takes place, like that of the Japanese in World War II?
It won't take long at all. Actually, it already happened after 9/11 under the immigration policies immediately after 9/11. There were hundreds of Muslims who were rounded up in this country in the immediate post 9/11 aftermath, all of them accused of some type of terrorism, and not one ever convicted of any terrorist crimes, although hundreds of them have already been deported quietly through this immigration system. So it's already happened. It's already happened.
First of all, I wanted to thank you for coming here and speaking to us and for continuing to do work to educate people about what's going on there. I also wanted to mention that Amnesty International has a table outside with petitions and letters if people want to stop by and sign. But my specific question was, when you got out of prison after that miscarriage of justice had happened to you, were you angry, and who did you feel was responsible for what had happened? Did you blame some of the other people you'd worked with at Guantanamo, or do you feel it was the political and military leaders?
Right. Who do I hold accountable? Many people. And how did I feel after all of this? For one, my faith in the current leadership of this country and in the current leadership of our military was severely shaken. Not in the military itself and not in our system of government, but in those who are in the positions of leadership was severely shaken. And I hold accountable people down in Guantanamo, specifically people who were involved in creating these rumors or putting me under investigation, and there were intelligence officers involved. And obviously they got it completely wrong. And that should be an indication that there is a huge amount of incompetence on the part of our U.S. intelligence agencies. And that should make everyone afraid. Because if they can't do a good job, then no doubt is another 9/11 going to happen. I mean, how do you think the first one happened? Because of incompetence. They let it slide. They let it happen. And I know firsthand from my experience that these intelligence officers were incorrectly analyzing information simply because they did not even have a thorough understanding of Islam, the religion, or Muslim culture. But I also hold accountable the commander of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, who would officially take responsibility for my arrest, for my imprisonment, and for bringing charges against me. And I believe that he was very instrumental in creating this atmosphere of anti-Muslim hostility down in Guantanamo, which led to much of the abuse down there, that in Major General Jeffrey Miller. But perhaps it even goes further than that, as it was suggested in the first news article that covered the story of the breaking news that I was in jail, indicating that the decision to arrest me was made at the highest levels, quote, at the highest levels of our government. And a two-star general down in Guantanamo, in my opinion, is not the highest level of our government. My case has gone, was much, much higher than that. But perhaps I'll never actually know exactly where.
Why do you think that you and the other prisoners who've been released have actually been released instead of just being detained forever or disappeared?
Why do you think, well, first of all, why was I released? Why do I believe I was released? In my personal situation, I was released, I would say, basically two major reasons. One, it's because I was completely innocent and there was no evidence whatsoever to hold me accountable for anything because I didn't do anything. And the other reason was legal expertise. And the attorney that I ended up retaining, in my view, is the top of the line with regard to military law. And perhaps without that level of legal representation, I could be on death row. You know, so the legal counsel in my case. But what about some of these guys down in Guantanamo?
Do you not think of the possibility that you were released to spread the fear amongst the Muslim community, to make them afraid, perhaps, be very afraid?
Perhaps the arrest. I might say that was done to create this fear and intimidation, not only in the Muslim community, but in the entire community. As I said, you know, we can take a West Point graduate, simply throw him in jail, U.S. citizen. So I actually raised that question in my book. You know, why was this done? Was it to create this atmosphere of fear and intimidation, which people will give up their freedoms, will give up their civil liberties, thinking that the government will better protect them because we're in danger.
James, I have more of a public service announcement and a comment. First, thank you for coming to shed light on your experience in Guantanamo Bay and here in the United States. I think we can all agree that this is a critical issue. And for all of you to know that we will be rebroadcasting this talk on 91.9 KCSB Radio, the non-commercial educational station located right here on campus. This talk will also be available as a thank you gift for our annual membership drive that's held in November. Also, KCSB will be featuring Jeremy Scahill with the release of his new book, Blackwater. We can all agree that Blackwater is the rise of the world's most powerful mercenary army here today. So if you'd like to see this and hear Jeremy Scahill for Thursday, April 26th, it'll be held at Isla Vista Theater. Quarter Page Fires are held in the back of the corridor. And again, James, thank you once more.
Good evening. Much has been, I shouldn't say much, but there have been scholars and different pundits who've discussed the correlation between repression and religious extremism. One example, glaring example, being the situation in Egypt and gross human rights violations and repressions in the prison system, and people drawing correlations between the rise of extremism, having, you know, fingernails ripped out of your hand or your fingers, leading to more black and white and more fundamentalist interpretations of the holy texts of Islam. And if Egypt is too far for a lot of Americans to understand, then there was an article in the LA Times recently talking about the relationship between radicalization of Iraqi prisoners in the Iraqi prisons. And so the question is, I mean, in your discussion on the manhandling and the severe physical abuses that are taking place in Guantanamo, and your ability to move in and out of the cell blocks and having these relationships with different prisoners, could you possibly comment on the psychological effects on some of these prisoners? And more importantly, if and when you did engage in subject matter dealing with religion, if you could notice differences of opinions and more radical opinions developing over the course of time. And again, I mean, now your own personal experience, having, you know, treated the way you were, could you possibly talk about own personal views on religion possibly becoming more radical and or more black and white under these dire situations? Thank you.
Yeah, these are interesting questions. You know, in terms of the population of prisoners down in Guantanamo, did I view a radicalization of these prisoners simply because they were held in Guantanamo? With many of these prisoners, I would say all of these prisoners, that they were very angry at America and the American government and at the U.S. military. And for many of them who were swept up and brought to Guantanamo, if they weren't angry at America before that, you can sure bet that they are now, being kept in Guantanamo for 6 years. So you see that extreme in terms of them being utterly angered because of simply being there and then being persecuted simply because they're Muslims and the types of things that they were subjected to with regard to the religion of these prisoners being Muslims. But I would say that we can go outside the prison camp, outside Guantanamo, and say that Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has led to increased extremism and anti-American sentiment in the world. I mean, when the world sees Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib and the abuse of prisoners by the U.S. military, that creates animosity towards America. And I'll say that, you know, Guantanamo has really done a disservice to the reputation of our nation and has really destroyed our nation's credibility with regard to being a nation that contends it's a leader of human rights or an upholder of the rule of law. I mean, the international community just doesn't buy that, you know, after these prison camps. With myself, you wanted to know specifically.
I mean, after having been in such a situation, did you feel yourself drawing upon or feeling more inclined to looking at verses that deal with certain issues as opposed to other? I suppose when you're in an interrogation situation and you're being manhandled, you're less likely to look at verses that deal with God in a very merciful and compassionate manner.
My own personal view, in terms of is the kind of question: was I being radicalized? My whole experience probably, you know, has made me that much more determined to advocate for those things I was advocating for as a chaplain: diversity, religious freedom, tolerance, equality, justice, humane treatment of prisoners. So in that sense, I've become radicalized. But going out and speaking, and you know, rather speaking to people like all of you rather than sleeping. I mean, in that way, I've become that radicalized. I mean, and believe me, the people in power today will view people like me as being radical now. So in that sense, the experience has rubbed off on me in that way. Yeah. Two more questions, and then we'll wrap it up here.
I'm a retired U.S. Army major. I served in Korea, a tour there, and two in Vietnam. And I've had quite a few incompetent, prejudiced, and biased commanding officers, so I understand what came to you. I had another question that's been pretty much answered in your comments to others. But the one thing that very concerned about is, why is a military command in Guantanamo so subject to this civilian direction in the intelligence gathering part of it? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, real quickly, I believe that the direction was coming from the civilian authority in the Pentagon, Rumsfeld's office, Cambone, directly to General Miller, who was the commander of Guantanamo. So the commander of Guantanamo was military. The actual intelligence operation, the commander of the intelligence operation at that time when I was down there was a civilian, who was directing the intelligence gathering at that time. At times there were military commanders running the intelligence operation, but it jumped back and forth between civilian and military. But yeah, I mean, these other government agencies is a large part, and I believe the direction was coming from the Pentagon. And that's about all I could really talk to on
Thank
that.
You.
I would like to know what happens to the Americans that go down there, the soldiers and the civilians. Do they come back sadistic monsters or what?
Great question. I would say that, first of all, in many ways, before they get down there, they get desensitized. I mean, the first thing they hear when they get down in Guantanamo is that all these guys are terrorists. The reason why they're here is because of 9/11. And, when they're instructed to carry out certain policies in the detention operation, whether it's abusing the Quran or, messing with the prisoners during prayer or force, shaving their beards, the prisoners take it out on the guards and they throw water at the guards and then, they have this impression that these guys are all terrorists and that that's the situation down there. And so, it opens the floor to abuses and whatnot. But what happens to these guys?
Yeah, what happens when they come back to this country? I mean, what kind of people who have done that come back to live with us?
Yeah, great question. I would love to have someone do a study of people who have served down in Guantanamo's guards and what happened when they reintegrated back to the U.S. We can look at people who come back who have already come back from Iraq, for example. I mean, you had that slew of murders of wives and girlfriends from these people at Fort Bragg. Post-traumatic stress disorder, is rampant. And then without a health care system, veterans' healthcare system to deal with this. I mean, we've seen, what happened at Walter Reed and whatnot. And of course, this is going to take a tremendous toll on the society. But the costs haven't been yet assessed, I guess. Who? Timothy McVeigh.
Hi, James. My name is Stan. I'm a former naval officer, and like yourself, I've handled a lot of classified information. I know as an officer, I may have documents that may say confidential, secret, top secret across the top. I also know as an officer there is a gray area, which a document may not be labeled as such, but I know as an officer I know how to handle that information. Can you be more precise, please? Tell us exactly what you had on your person that was caused to be suspect.
What did I actually have?
What did you actually have, precisely?
Yeah, what I learned about just me being arrested, I learned through a very crafty investigative journalist who had learned that actually I wasn't supposed to have been arrested that day. They wanted to follow me and catch me in the act of turning over some classified information to some Al-Qaeda operatives in the United States. But when they harassed me at the airport, they felt that I had caught on to their scheme and that they needed to arrest me right away. So how did they need to arrest me? They need to come up with a reason. So they started saying I had all of these classified documents and whatnot. Much of what I had on me in my backpack were actually articles that I had printed off the internet about Syria and the Syrian presidents. And why? Because I was enrolled in a master's degree course in international relations. I was in a course on Middle Eastern politics. I had a research paper due in about 3 weeks, and I had needed to go home, finish that paper, and that was one of the things I was going to do on that two-week break. And when I got interrogated by these FBI guys, they would ask me, why do you have all these information about Syria? Are you spying also for the Syrian government? Did these Syrian detainees down here, were they helping you with this research paper that supposedly you're doing? And so that's the bulk of what I had it. They would claim that I had names of interrogators and actual information about specific interrogation sessions, which was not true on me. There was a similar situation with a Syrian-American translator who got arrested, and they would claim that he was taking like 200 classified documents, which were letters that had been translated from families back and forth to detainees as he was a translator. And it turned out that they, too, were not classified. So in that aspect, it was nothing that I really had. They would say I had maps of the base, and all of this stuff was you know, leaked to the media saying that I had all of this kind of stuff. I was fortunate to receive that research back in time for me to finish that paper after I got a six-month extension. And I would later complete the degree and get my master's in international relations this past June.
That just a follow-up to that, that does sound so innocent. Why were you put in solitary confinement for research material paper? That just doesn't ring a chord with me.
Yeah.
Can you explain that, please?
I mean, for one, I was someone who actually had been through ComSec training, communication security. So I was well trained on what to do with classified information, even more so than the security officer down in Guantanamo, who was in an intel position, not even an MI officer. He was one who was behind putting many of us Muslims under investigation with the counterintelligence unit, you know, all the way up back in D.C. So I had the proper training with regard to classified information, even serving as a ComSec officer for the unit that I was with with the Patriot. So with all the training, you know, I had all the training, and, you know, I didn't have any classified documents, never handled anything, so. And that's ultimately why they would let me go. With that, we're going to wrap it up here, and I guess I'm available for those who actually would like to get a book signed and be happy to
thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.